afternoon, I'm going to call the last case for the October sitting, 97-1490FT, Christina Holman versus Family Health Plan. Attorney Ryan J. Hetzel representing the Family Health Plan. Mr. Hetzel.
Good afternoon, Honorable Justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'm Attorney Ryan Hetzel, and I represent Family Health Plan, a Wisconsin corporation which provides health insurance and other health services to the public. We're here before you today asking for two things. First, we'd like a reversal of the Court of Appeals and the trial court and reinstatement of our subrogation rights. The second thing we're asking for from you today is a clarification on the law as to how subrogated parties should be joined in lawsuits. It is Family Health Plan's position that parties with subrogated interests should be joined as parties plaintiff. In this case, they were joined as a party defendant, failed to file an answer, and ultimately dismissed. Now, there are a number of reasons why it is our position that they should have been joined, that we should have been joined as a plaintiff. First of all, there are the statutory grounds. Beginning with section 80303, sub 2, which is entitled Joinder of Related Claims, the statute clearly mandates that parties with subrogated interests shall join the parties bringing the claim. And if I can read from it, any party asserting a claim based upon subrogation to part of the claim of another, or assignment of a part of the claim of another, shall join as a party to the action the person to whose rights the party is subrogated, from whose claim the party derives his or her rights or claim, or by whose assignment the party acquired his or her rights. They shall join that party. The statute's relatively clear. Moving along in section 80303 to sub 2, sub B, options after joinder. Again, the statute makes it clear that the party should be joined as a plaintiff. As a plaintiff, the options indicated are, number one, participate in the prosecution of the action. Number two, agree to have his or her interests represented by the party who caused the joinder. And number three, move for dismissal with or without prejudice. Now, clearly, participating in the prosecution of the action denotes or clearly implicates that the party should be joined as a plaintiff in order to prosecute the action. Second, to have that party's interest represented by the party who caused the joinder would certainly create conflicts if we have a plaintiff representing the interest of a defendant. It doesn't make sense. It's contrary to all civil procedure that we're taught. If you're going to be representing the interest of another party, you should at least be on the same side of the line in the caption.
Counsel,
yes.
If you prevail on that issue, and I think the Court of Appeals said they assumed you were right without really answering it. But if you should prevail on that issue, then does that give you a defense at law if somebody joins, or somebody names you the subrogated party as the defendant?
Can you repeat the question?
Well, let me put it a different way so I'm not trapping you. The Court of Appeals said that even if you're named wrongly, in error, as a defendant, nevertheless, as a defendant, you have a duty to raise as a defense at law that error.
Correct.
What I'm asking you is, where does it get you, even if you prevail, and we should hold that there was a mistake made here and they should have been named as a plaintiff?
Okay. Yeah, the Court of Appeals said we needed to raise that within 20 days in a response of pleading to the complaint. It's our position that that is error because, first of all, the Court of Appeals quotes that we were misjoined and says we need to raise that as a defense in law. Now, there's been no indication prior to this that misjoinder was a necessary defense in a response of pleading to the complaint. In other words, prior to this, misjoinder did not need to be raised within 20 days. And in fact, if we look at the misjoinder statute, which is 80306, it states that misjoinder of parties is not a grounds for dismissal of an action, and that parties may be dropped or added by order of the court or on motion of any party or on the court's own initiative at any stage of the action and on such terms as are just. So there's no 20-day bright line time limit on the misjoinder statute. Now, if we follow Radloff, which is the decision regarding 80303 sub 2B. The subrogated insurer needs to make a decision. Radloff never set a bright line time deadline on when that decision needed to be made. In that case, the defendant insurer, the subrogated insurer was named as a defendant, so similar to this. But in that case, there was never a motion for default brought, so the subrogated insurer just sat up there and did nothing. Now, when the parties tried to settle the case, the subrogated insurer stepped in and said, wait a minute, we have our money coming to us. And at that point, the court stepped in and said, you needed to make a decision, you didn't do that, you sat on your rights, now you're going to be dismissed. That's the same situation here, but Family Health Plan did not sit on its rights. As soon as Family Health Plan found out that there was a default judgment out there, we moved to reopen, we made our appearance, and in fact, the trial court noted that our motion to reopen was timely. So it's not a case where we sat on our rights.
Mr. Hatzell, did you make any claim of excusable neglect?
No, we did not. It was been our position all along that we should have been named as a plaintiff and therefore did not need to even respond to the complaint, since if we were named as a plaintiff, no responsive pleading is necessary.
So you from the beginning took the position that you did not have to respond within the 20 days?
That's correct.
Were you given notice of the default judgment?
I believe not. To be honest with you, I was not originally on this case. In fact, I did not have my license when this case was commenced. We made our appearance, albeit late, and were then given notice by the plaintiff that a default judgment had been entered already.
You got notice that the judgment had been entered.
That's correct.
Not notice that they were going to do that.
And following the notice of that, we brought the motion to reopen. That's correct.
Counsel, regarding getting notice, the way that I view and look at the docket sheet, a summons and complaint was filed. There was an subsequent amended complaint that was filed on January 23rd. I think the summons and complaint was filed, I believe, on January 17th.
Correct.
There is an affidavit in support of the motion for default, saying that you failed to respond to the original complaint. There's nothing in the docket sheet that indicates that you were ever served with the amended complaint. Two questions. Number one, were you ever served with the amended complaint? Question number two, my understanding of the law is that an amended complaint supersedes the original complaint and makes the original complaint a nullity. The second question is that also your understanding of the law?
Okay, on the first issue, the service of the original complaint was made on Family Health Plan Cooperative. We are not an in-house counsel. They then subsequently shipped those complaints to us. Our office never did receive the amended complaint.
Did Family Health Plan?
I'm not certain that they did or didn't. I know that we never received it.
Have you raised that as a defense in this matter?
No, we have not. It has not been our defense from the beginning. Whether or not the fact that we failed to file an answer in the first one and the amended complaint would subsequently make our failure to answer that a nullity, I would say not in this case, because the subsequent amended complaint was filed strictly to amend the name of the defendant insurer in this case. Our status in the proceeding was not changed. So I believe our failure to file an answer on the first complaint would be controlling.
Do you think that, there are a long line of cases that say an amended complaint make the original complaint a nullity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that if it's only a minor amendment, that general proposition isn't true?
No, I don't. No, that may very well be the case that, in fact, this is a nullity, but our position from the get-go has been that our failure to answer the original complaint should not have resulted in us being dismissed from the action.
If you fail to raise, I don't know if this is, I assume it's jurisdictional. If you fail to raise
failure, you know, this is kind of hypothetical. If you fail to raise, failing to be served, and if it's jurisdictional, service is jurisdictional, what's the result of that? If you know. I'm using I'm asking because I don't know.
I believe because we
That's a good answer for you, too, if
yes.
you have to ask. We hear that a lot.
Yeah,
because, don't hear as much as we should, probably.
Because we haven't raised it, I'm not certain. I think the point is somewhat moot in the fact that we haven't raised that defense to this point. If it is jurisdictional defect, I would argue that there's no need to be here today.
There was no complaint, no answer was needed, and there's no default.
Certainly. And I can't say for certain because I don't know whether or not Family Health Plan received the amended complaint. I'm assuming that they did based on how we received the first one.
But, I mean, I've gone through the docket sheet. There's the amended complaint was served on two other entities, I've got it here someplace, and that was filed, but there was nothing filed in affidavit of service of the amended complaint that's on here. So maybe...
It's a possibility that...
I just don't know. I'm perplexed by it.
I know in going through our file, we have no copy of an amended complaint, so I can't say for certain whether or not Family Health Plan was served. Our office certainly never received it.
Well, it appears you have a lot of defenses in here, but you stuck with one.
Yes, for good reason.
You have to do it. You didn't do it.
Well, the reason that we stuck with the defense that we should have been joined as a plaintiff is because, or the long-term consequences, if this court should rule in our favor, it will end up, number one, promoting judicial economy, and that is, you will not have these motions for default judgments and motions to reopen. In my limited practice, I've been through a number of them, and this is the first in my own experience that's come down the way it has, and that is the subrogated insurer being dismissed. Normally, these are reopened and they're realigned as a party plaintiff. And I think the law is relatively clear that they should be named plaintiffs, but plaintiffs' attorneys continue to name them as defendants for obvious reasons. You can't get a default judgment against a involuntary plaintiff or a co-plaintiff. It sort of ties in with the collateral source rule, and that is once the subrogated insurer is out there, there's no medical bills to pay, and you know, hopefully the plaintiff can collect on those. So it's a trial strategy. The law is somewhat gray, although not as gray as the plaintiffs or the respondents in this case would like it to be, and they continue to do that. So it behooves my client, Family Health Plan, to number one, not have to file answers to complaints when they don't need to, and number two, not have to be in court moving to reclassify them or to correct the caption, move them to a plaintiff, and not having to answer the complaint.
Well, suppose they had listed you as a plaintiff or an involuntary plaintiff, then what would you have done?
Well, very clearly under Radloff and 803.03 sub 2b, we have to make a decision. And the respondents have argued that, well, they'll just sit back and do nothing. Well, that's not true. Under Radloff, we certainly need to make one of those three choices that are enumerated in the statute. And any client, any subrogated party that wants to pursue its interest, you know, wants the money coming in, is going to make its intentions known.
And how do you do that, counsel?
Well, you send a letter to the plaintiff with a notice of appearance to the court stating we have a subrogated interest here, we intend on pursuing it, or you send a document to the plaintiff saying, will you accept assignment of our rights and prosecute the action for us? Or if in a case where they evaluated that there's either too little money to get involved or it's a potential Rhymes-type case, they can voluntarily dismiss their action and not have to go through the expense of litigating the matter.
Counsel, maybe you have an argument that you don't have to raise an affirmative defense of misjoinder because it's not required. Failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is an affirmative defense that I think is required to be raised. Maybe I'm wrong. But if I'm right, why didn't you raise that, looking at both the complaint and the amended complaint in paragraph 6, an averment is made saying that you paid money and that you may have a claim for subrogation. Hardly joinder of issues. It is not a claim against you. You are named the defendant, the averment in the complaint and amended complaint set forth in number 6. And I think no way can be interpreted as having a claim against you. So, why aren't you, since you are named as a defendant, why aren't you obligated to raise a failure to state a claim upon which relief can't be granted?
Well, because there really is no claim, we are named as a defendant.
That's right, because there is no claim, so there can be no relief on that claim. The failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is this, can be this type of thing.
I guess in a sense it could be, although that would be a strange way of looking at it, in the sense that if they took a judgment against us with no claim against us, there would be no result.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe under paragraph 6, a claim is set forth, because you do have a judgment, and you do have a result.
Well, true, in the sense that we were defaulted out of it, but there is no claim other than the fact that the complaint alleges that if we do not answer in time, they're going to move for dismissal of our interest, and that's what we're looking at. But again, from the beginning, because they haven't followed, because we were misjoined, and because they haven't followed, number one, the statutory scheme, they haven't followed the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the statutory scheme, and also the common law, and I haven't even begun to touch on the common law aspects of this case, but from the beginning, the language in the case law has been that the doctrine of subrogation contemplates full substitution and places the party subrogated in the shoes of the plaintiff. And that's General Accident Insurance Co. versus Schoendorf and Sergey. A party with a subrogated claim has an independent, albeit a derivative claim. That's Gary versus Rural Mutual Insurance. The original right of the plaintiff measures the extent of the subrogated party's rights. That's General Accident Insurance Co. versus Schoendorf and Sergey again. And finally, the courts have characterized the interests of the insurer and the insurers each owning separately a part of the claim against the tortfeasor. And that's really who we're pursuing in this matter. We both have an interest in recovering money from that tortfeasor. The statutes say we should be joined as a plaintiff. The case law, and quoted in the brief in Anderson, which says the statutory scheme clearly contemplates joining the subrogated insurer as a party plaintiff. The fact that Sampson relies on that as authority for amending a caption to name Milwaukee County as a plaintiff to tax costs against it. All these things indicate we should have been named as a plaintiff. So why then should the plaintiff, in this case, benefit from deliberate misjoinder? And that's what we're looking at here.
Well, counsel, take a hypothetical. I would assume that there are many, many defendants that are named as defendants who, in retrospect, you could say the same thing about. They never should have been named as a defendant, so they're out. They prevailed in a summary judgment, or there was a mistaken identity or something. Let's assume a mistaken identity. You sue me because you think I did something to you, and in fact, you were mistaken as to that identity. So if you sue me and I say, I don't even know this attorney Hetzel, can I just ignore the complaint?
No, you shouldn't ignore the complaint.
Why is this different?
In this situation, what the subrogated party needs to do is established by statute under 2B, and that is you've got to make that decision, and there's been no bright line on it. We did bring a motion to reopen within reasonable time once we found out. And
the time that you brought the motion was beyond the time, the statutory time, correct?
Beyond the time for filing a responsive pleading, correct. But within the time set forth in Ratliff, which is a reasonable time to make that decision. And so we did respond to that. It's not that we sat back and did nothing. Was this practice sloppy, like the trial court said? Yes. Should an answer them all the time? Most likely yes. But at the same time, once we found out, we did file our answer, we did file our motion to reopen, and we did it within a reasonable time and made our decision. Following up on the court's hypothetical,
further clarification, say once you found out about the default judgment, is that, or once you found out about, what, once we found out what?
Yeah, what happened was we sent in a notice of appearance late.
You sent the notice of appearance in after the default judgment was taken?
I believe the notice of appearance, yes.
Yeah,
we were unaware of it.
So everything prior to the default, in other words, it's fair to say you were served, you did nothing, a default was taken. After the default was taken, then you served a notice of appearance and started and got involved. Is that...
That's not entirely accurate.
Okay, tell me what isn't accurate about it.
We were served with a summons complaint. I'm not certain when exactly our law office got it, but we were served with a complaint. We filed our notice of appearance. We then received notice from the plaintiff that a default judgment had been taken. So that was subsequent to our serving our notice of appearance. We then filed the paperwork regarding the motion to appeal.
Okay, the summons complaint, but the note, I'm just trying to track this. The notice of appearance went in after the 20 days for answering the complaint?
Okay. And the notice of appearance in our answer did state that if we were improperly named as a defendant, we should be named as a plaintiff or an involuntary plaintiff.
Thank you.
Mr. Hetzel?
Yes.
You want us to interpret that parties with a, or potential parties with a subrogation interest be named as, joined as plaintiffs. There have been cases where they've been joined as defendants.
Yes.
Why should the court find that they can be joined either as plaintiffs or defendants, depending on the circumstances?
Okay, number one, because the statutory scheme, which I've just read to the court, strongly indicates that they should be named plaintiffs. It's joined with related claims. Their interests derive from the same source, and that is the plaintiff being injured, the payment of medical bills, and they both have a claim against the tortfeasor. Now, the only instance that I can foresee where there's going to be an adverse relationship between the subrogated insurer and the plaintiff is when there's limited funds that were set forth in Schulte. In those situations, the plaintiff is protected because they have the right to a Rimes hearing. So as long as there are not limited funds, they're both seeking the same thing, and that's the recovery of the money they've had to pay as a result of the tortfeasor's acts. Their interests are identical. No reason to name them as defendants.
Surely the legislature could have said that people should be joined as plaintiffs or defendants. It didn't seem to do that explicitly.
It did not say that in clear black letter. It did not state that. However, by reading through the rest of the statute, it's very clear what they intended. And the Court of Appeals has indicated that that's what they intended and has interpreted the statutes that way, both in Anderson versus Garber and in Sampson versus Lowell.
Now, is there anything in the Judicial Council Committee notes that would help us?
I haven't.
Pardon me?
I haven't found anything in them. In the Judicial Council notes?
Yeah. This was a Judicial Council Committee report, and it was adopted by Supreme Court order. Isn't that right? 803, right? Chapter 803?
That's correct.
And I'm just asking if when you went through the committee notes, you found anything that would help you.
No, I didn't. But at the same time, I think the language in the statute is relatively clear. And I would point out 80303, sub 3, which is determination by the court whenever joinder is not feasible. And the second line in states, if the party should join as a plaintiff but refuses to do so, the party may be made a defendant or, in a proper case, an involuntary plaintiff. That language alone indicates that where the party should be joined as a plaintiff, which we say we should have been, the plaintiff then has an obligation at least to come to us and say, we're going to join you in this, will you join? And then we make the decision as to either, sure, we'll join as a plaintiff, or no, we're not going to join as a plaintiff, and then they have the right to name us a defendant or an involuntary plaintiff.
And doesn't the language you just quoted entertain the possibility that a party is going to be joined as a defendant in an appropriate circumstance?
In an appropriate circumstance, but this is not one of those circumstances. Clearly our rights are derived from the same source. They mirror each other. And the statutory scheme prior to that indicates that with our decision to participate in the prosecution of the action, That clearly contemplates joining the plaintiff alongside the plaintiff. I don't know how a defendant can prosecute an action. Agree to have your interest represented by that party. Again, I don't know how a defendant can agree to have a plaintiff represent their rights unless they should have been named as a plaintiff from the beginning.
Mr. Hetzel, do you agree that if we should conclude that they do not have to be named as a party plaintiff, but you can name them as a plaintiff or a defendant, then you lose on the next issue, right? Because if they could do either, then for sure they had a duty to respond to the complaint.
That's correct. If the court concludes that they could do either, we would lose this decision, correct? Thank you.
Mr. Lewis, you represent Christina Holman and Mr. Holman.
Honorable Chief Justice, Justices, this is a case about default judgments, not a case about how you denominate a subrogated carrier. I will address the issue of how you denominate a subrogated carrier in my argument because that is being brought up by the appellant. However, this is simply a case where a default judgment was entered against a party within the discretion of the trial court. The trial court was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. On January 17, 1997, Family Health Plan was served with the summons and complaint as a defendant.
The original summons and complaint.
The original summons and complaint. The summons had the standard language in effect at that time, which said, if you do not provide a proper answer within 20 days, the court may grant judgment against you for the award of money or other legal action requested in the complaint, and you may lose your right to object to anything that is or may be incorrect in the complaint. That's what the summons in part says to the party receiving it. The complaint alleged that Family Health Plan may have a claim for subrogation because that was the knowledge we had at the time, that they made payments and they may assert a right. That's what the complaint states. The complaint also states in paragraph 6 of the addendum clause, if you don't respond on time to this complaint, we will ask the court to enter an order finding that you have no claim. This is basically an issue of waiver. If you're served in a lawsuit with a pleading and you do nothing within the time that the summons says you have to act, you have waived your right. That is what, in effect, this case stands for. Waiver by a subrogated carrier of its right to participate in a lawsuit. The default judgment was then taken on February 10, 1997, based upon the 20 days after service having expired and no responsive pleading or objection or appearance having been entered. It was not until March 24, 1997, 42 days after the default judgment was taken and nearly 2 months after service of process, that a pleading was filed on behalf of Family Health Plan.
So let me ask you the same area of inquiry, probably no surprise to you, that I asked your opposing counsel. I believe the file reflects that the original summons and complaint was filed on January 7th. The affidavit of service on Family Health is dated January 17th. The file further reflects that an amended summons and complaint was filed on January 23rd, and that two of the three defendants were served with this amended complaint. One defendant was served on January 27th, according to the affidavit of service and file, and another was served on February 5th. The motion for default judgment, asking for default for failure to answer the original complaint, was filed on February 10th. I'm unable to find, maybe it's there, any indication that the Family Health Plan was served with the amended complaint. Let me ask, was Family Health Plan served with the amended complaint, and is there any affidavit of service of the amended complaint on that?
The issue was not raised prior to this afternoon. I looked in my file during Mr. Hetzel's argument. I could not find one. That does not mean there isn't one. That means I could not find one. The issue was never raised by Family Health Plan before the trial court or before the appellate court or before this court. I believe that issue would have been waived if there would have been any defense.
There are some black letter maxims of the law. I'm not sure they apply here, because this hasn't been raised, so I'm not sure that it applied here.
The black letter maxims of the law are the service, I believe, service of summons and complaint is jurisdictional. Another black letter maxim of the law is that you can't confer jurisdiction. So I have those things swimming, if you will, in my mind that maybe suggest there's no jurisdiction, it can't be conferred, and what are we doing? So do you have any response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Jurisdiction was conferred when Family Health Plan was served with the summons and complaint. The amendment only corrected the identity of one of the other party defendants. That is, CNA and Continental, there was a third related companies, and the incorrect one was originally named, and there's nothing substantive in the pleadings that changes other than the name of the other insurer that is a party. So I don't believe that this issue would apply in this case.
It may not at all. I mean, I'm just raising it. I note that the practice manuals and the cases cited indicate when an amendment pleading is filed, the original is superseded and drops out of the case for all purposes. And then some of the cases cited, I've just done this quickly. So that concerns me, but your position that how do you respond? If that's a correct statement of the law, that amended complaints supersede prior complaints and the original is superseded and drops out of the case for all purposes.
I will candidly indicate I have not researched that particular issue because I didn't know it to be involved in this case.
Understand.
But my understanding is when you have simply a technical change in the denomination of a party, just the name of the party, that is not a substantive change which would cause the original action to fall out.
But of course, the defendant says that you're raising a technical means of getting out, too, right? How can we decide this case, counsel, if there was an amended summons and complaint that was never served? That was never served on FHP.
Your Honor, he can't
confer jurisdiction by waiving a jurisdiction. He can't waive a jurisdictional issue, can he?
My view is that jurisdiction occurred because of service of the original summons and complaint.
Because of what? I'm sorry.
Because the original summons and complaint was served on Family Health Plan.
Yes, once you filed an amended summons and complaint, that first summons and complaint is not worth it's whistling on the wind. No, there's nothing there. We're working with the second summons and complaint, are we not?
What did you get a default judgment on?
The original. I have a motion.
We've got a default judgment entered in this case.
Yes, but on the second summons and complaint.
In the action and I don't know that any distinction was
According to this, and I think there's it may be in your appendix too, it says I am one of the attorneys of record. The action was duly commenced by filing with the clerk of courts on January 7th, 1997. Family Health Plan was duly served for the summons and complaint on January 7th. A copy is attached. Family Health Plan has failed to answer, and the time for doing so has long expired. So is that the first one?
The service referred to the original complaint. I'm looking at the caption of the pleading, and it appears that the caption of the default judgment has the caption of the amended pleading.
Of the amended pleading?
That is...
Date of service was 1/17/97. What's the date of the amended pleading?
23rd of January.
Well, then it's the first one that you've got. That's the only one you have here. You have an affidavit of personal service, dated service January 17th. That precedes the second.
So, correct. It was...
Did I hear you wrong? What did you say about the 20? Did you say something about the 23rd of January?
That is the amended.
Okay.
So this is all based on the first one.
The default occurred on the original complaint, Your Honor.
Had the time for answering passed on the amended complaint?
The time for answering on the amended complaint had not passed as of the date of the default judgment on the first complaint, but I mean, I was not aware of this issue, and I have not had the opportunity to review the court record regarding the issue of service of process of the amended summons and complaint, so I don't know if that occurred. I would tend to think that it did not occur.
What didn't occur, sir?
Service of the amended summons and complaint of family health plan. I can't find an affidavit of service. Okay.
And you didn't get a default judgment on the second one.
That is correct.
So we're going in, you now have two complaints in this action, right?
The original complaint and the complaint was amended to...
Amended complaint and the original complaint is what you took a default judgment on, but there's an amended complaint. What are you going out after the other defendants on? Are they answering the amended complaint?
They answered both. And that part of the case has long since been resolved.
Well, it seems as if there's been a little error on both sides, maybe.
I respect the court's view on that.
Well, I don't know if it's my view. It seemed like an appropriate comment to end that discussion.
It's a segue into something.
Next thing. I'll segue. I'll tell you what bothers me. I'm bothered when somebody doesn't respond. Misjoined and non-joined, I don't care. You get a piece of paper from the court, time's ticking away. You don't take any chances. You say something. Anything. I want an extension to consider it. Something. So that the court knows you're alive and out there talking to it. And we want the process to go like that. And then people know where they stand when there's a response. So, regardless of whether the misjoinder statute says it's not applicable, it's sound practice to respond to something, even if you're going to say, I don't have to respond. So, on that side, I that's my view, or at least a view I'm taking for purposes of this discussion. On the other hand, default judgments are not favored. We try and give people an opportunity to be in court, an opportunity to be heard, present their case, and make a decision on the merits. That's the favored position. And at least when I practiced law, if somebody was a defendant and they didn't respond, you might call the lawyer and say, hey, what's up? I'm going to take a default judgment if you don't do something. You need an extension? Okay, but... Otherwise, we're going. And the reason I would do that, frankly, is not because I was just such a nice litigant. It was that they'd open it up on me, and it would waste a lot of my time, a lot of my client's time, and a lot of my client's money. So rather than take a default and then get it opened in a week and a half, may as well come to terms with the other side, right? And here, within a very short time, I mean, we're talking about less than a month or thereabouts, you get a default judgment. Pretty quick. I mean, the ink's not dry. I guess there's no ink anymore, but I would have said in the old days, the ink's not dry on your amended complaint, and you're in there on a default judgment against Family Health Plan. And the default judgment isn't dry yet, and they're in there asking to open it up. So you don't have a lot of... delay, you don't have a lot of extra work on your part, you don't have a lot of extra work on Family Health Plan. So how does it come to this? I mean, it just strikes me, you were fast on the trigger, they were slow on the trigger, you were fast on the trigger, the court is letting a default judgment go when no opportunity to be heard. It really is sort of an irritant. You respond.
My response is just what the trial court viewed in this case. There was nothing submitted by Family Health Plan as a defense. There was no affidavit saying there was a mistake, there was inadvertence, there was excusable neglect. They simply gave no explanation to the trial court. There was no explanation given to me as to why they waited.
Well, the explanation is that under the statute, they had a reasonable interpretation that said there was a misjoinder and they don't have to respond. So to me, if I were listening to this and when I read it, it seemed to me that was excusable neglect. They had a reasonable basis in law and fact to not respond. It turns out they were wrong, at least by the trial court's view, they were wrong. That sounds like excusable neglect. I mean, do they have to stand around and say excusable neglect, and pound their chests?
Your Honor, I think the Martin case, which we cited in our brief, is right on point. A party cannot rely upon a mistaken understanding of the law as a basis not to respond to a pleading. In the Martin case, an excess carrier who was named as a defendant did not file a response of pleading, believing that the claim would not exceed the underlying coverage. And the court basically held it is not excusable neglect as a matter of law for an insurance company to fail to file a timely answer due to the good faith belief of its personnel that since there appeared to be a primary insurer with coverage exceeding damages alleged in the complaint, that Wisconsin law did not require an answer. We have an analogous situation here. An insurer can't rely on a misinterpretation of the law as a basis not to answer a pleading. I mean, our view is that the trial court had discretion. We cited the case law that gives the trial court discretion to award a default judgment and to deny a relief from the default judgment. And the trial court basically said in its decision that there's no explanation or excuse, not one scintilla of evidentiary fact as to why it did nothing within 20 days after being put on notice. That's from page 12 of the trial court's decision. So the trial court says there's no reason why they didn't answer this complaint that I accept in my discretion. Default judgment upheld. So I think that's what this case is all about, and we don't need to reach any other issue. But if we do get to the issue of how you should properly denominate a subrogated carrier in a complaint, I disagree with Mr. Hetzel's interpretation of 803.03. The statute does not in any language state that a subrogated party is to be named a plaintiff. The statute mandates joinder of subrogated parties. 803.03 paren 2 requires that all parties shall be joined. So it's mandatory joinder, but there is no language saying, how do you name them? Do you name them as a plaintiff? Do you name them as a defendant?
How do you think they should be named? You handle a lot of these cases.
I name them routinely as a defendant. I've been doing that forever. Except workers' compensation and except Medicare and Medicaid because they have statutory super lien rights. And in those cases, they're named as a plaintiff. When you're dealing with a subrogated medical provider, I name them as a defendant.
Is that standard practice in the community?
That's what I see more often.
But there's just as much practice the other way, or at least some?
I don't believe that there's much practice the other way. That's been my practical experience doing this. I mean, I interpreted 803.03, subparagraph 3, where there's the discussion as to the court having the ability to join a party who should be a plaintiff as a defendant, as indicating that there is an option, that you can name a party as a plaintiff or a defendant, that it's optional. We do have some dicta in the Sampson case and the Anderson versus Garber case, which I'll hopefully have a little time to address later. But what I want to address is what I view as the practical problems of designating a subrogated party as a plaintiff. The first question is, what relationship would I, in this case, or any plaintiff's attorney, have to the subrogated party if I simply name them as a plaintiff? Do I somehow take them on as a client and have an ethical obligation to represent their interest? Do I then have an affirmative obligation to prove up the subrogated carrier's claim, even though I represent the accident victim and not the subrogated carrier? What happens if I don't get cooperation from the subrogated carrier and I've named them as a plaintiff? There seem to be some real problems with the subrogated carrier and the victim having adverse interests. There are a lot of different scenarios where the interests are adverse, and I'll run through those that I've run across over the years. First and foremost is the whole made-whole issue, the Garrity-Rhymes type issue. When there's insufficient money to go around, or where there's a concern that maybe the money won't be sufficient to go around, there's a dispute, a conflict between the subrogated carrier's interest and the accident victim's interest. Oftentimes you get policy language disputes with the subrogated carrier. A good example is if you have an uninsured motorist or an underinsured motorist case where the policy allows for litigating those issues, there may be a subrogated medical provider who says, I have a subrogation claim versus your uninsured motorist benefits or versus your underinsured motorist benefits. How can you name the subrogated medical provider as a party plaintiff together with the accident victim when you're going after uninsured motorist rights and you as the victim's lawyer are saying you don't have subrogation against uninsured motorist rights or you don't have subrogation against underinsured motorist rights? There's a direct conflict of interest, and plaintiff's counsel for the victim is trying to take the position the subrogated carrier has no claim. So you've got that type of policy issue.
Also, it seems to me that the statute, although I can't place my hand on it right now, no contemplates these conflict cases. That's why they give options. If I recall, the statute says the subrogated carrier can assign the cause of action to you as plaintiff's attorney. The subrogated carrier can answer and prosecute the claim on their own. And I mean, very typically when there are conflict situations made, when Rhymes and Garrity come into play, I mean, as a trial judge, you sit there and you fume a little bit because, with all due respect, sometimes the subrogated carriers aren't doing anything. They just show up for the day of trial and put in their, don't even stay for the whole trial, just put in enough to prove up their payments and go home, you know. Like a little more enthusiasm than that. But the statute doesn't require it. So, you know, I guess I don't find this conflict stuff compelling because we have it all the time, and the statute giving the options of what the subrogated carrier can do contemplates that and addresses it. What's your response?
Well, I disagree with the fact that this isn't a problem. It's not a problem if you name them as a defendant and they have their own lawyer. Then they can select their options. But if
they always have, I mean, they always, and these are insurance companies. I mean, they always have the options. It's not like they're a pro se litigant who doesn't know what's going on in a courtroom. I mean, generally, they farm these out and they have the same lawyer handle all of them in a big part of the state.
Correct. But what I'm saying is if we take Attorney Hetzel's proposition that they are named as a plaintiff and they don't have to plead, then we have these problems. Then what occurs? I mean, how would I, if I'm joining Family Health Plan as a plaintiff, how do I then respond? The other issue I have is what pleadings does Family Health Plan as a plaintiff have to produce to assert its claim, particularly in a situation where we've got a Rhymes issue or a policy coverage issue? What do they do? Does Family Health Plan as a, or the subrogated party as a plaintiff, then sue back the plaintiff? Typically, I name the subrogated party as a defendant. They counterclaim back as against the plaintiff, saying, you as the plaintiff have obligations to pay us. That's the typical scenario. If they're a plaintiff instead, what are the pleadings?
That's just it. If they're a plaintiff, they put in a notice of appearance, and they don't have to plead because there's no claim against them. There's no cause of action set forth in the complaint. I mean, that's what their argument is. There's no need to respond because there's no cause of action. All you have to do is show interest that you're going to prosecute the claim, and you do that by filing a notice of appearance.
But there are scenarios where they would have to plead, where there is going to be a dispute between the subrogated carrier and the accident victim. And if I'm serving the pleadings and I'm naming the subrogated carrier as a plaintiff, you know, what am I supposed to do if they don't appear? I filed the action on their behalf. I mean, that's literally what I've done as plaintiff's counsel.
I know, and that's always a drag because you feel like you're working, you know, doing their work for them. But, I mean, one of the prior cases is if they don't prosecute it, then you can get it dismissed. You know, whatever the case was, that's what that was.
The Radloff case, but in Radloff, they were named as a defendant. See, that's what I'm saying, that's the more practical and pragmatic alternative is to name them as a defendant if they do not participate in the case, if they do not appear and elect one of their options, then they can be deemed to have waived their interest. And I have since This case went on appeal, revised the language. I still name them as defendants, but I've revised the language that I used to specifically plead waiver in that language, saying, if you don't respond, we are going to take the position you have waived any right to participate in this case and waived your options under 803, which I think is now a more prudent way to plead it. But I think the same effect applies in this case. They have to be joined as a party, but it is not practical, particularly in run-of-the-mill cases, and I'm not denigrating my client's case, but this is a routine auto accident case. We've got about a $3,000 subrogation interest on the part of Family Health Plan, and we're before your honors in a case that I concluded for $20,000 on behalf of the plaintiffs about a year and a half ago. And in cases like this, it really isn't practical to require plaintiff's counsel to go through these machinations and name the subrogated carrier as a plaintiff, whereas pragmatically, if you name them as a defendant and they don't bother to show up in a timely fashion, you can just say, you've given up your claim. And I think the trial court in this case simply said, this is a case where they didn't appear in a timely fashion. I'm not reaching the issue of whether they should have been named as a plaintiff because they didn't appear on time, and therefore the default judgment is valid, and I think that your honors don't need to address the issue of whether they should be named as a plaintiff or a defendant and simply view this as a default judgment case where the trial court exercised its discretion. That's exactly what the appellate court said. The appellate court says, we're not reaching the issue. We'll assume arguendo that they should have been a plaintiff. Even if they should have been a plaintiff, they had to appear on time. They didn't appear on time. They lose.
What's at stake here?
$3,000? $3,000, Your Honor. Approximately, round numbers. Thank you.
Could I ask you one question, counsel? When you move for a default judgment, did Family Health get any notice of the motion?
Family Health Plan did not get notice of the motion. It just filed a motion saying they have not appeared. We're requesting that they be dismissed.
Is that standard appearance, or is it a standard procedure?
That's when we're not asking for a judgment against them, but rather asking for them to be essentially dismissed out of the case, yes.
Anybody thought of retreating this case? You got three parties, you got $3,000. The answer seems pretty clear.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to get this on the record, but there have been efforts to resolve it. My understanding is that the appellant wanted 100% or nothing.
Well, we do have an affidavit of service of the amended complaint on Continental in here. And then the other defendant. On the other defendant.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hetzel.
Thank you. I would argue that it's not totally correct to say that this case is about $3,000. While the facts of this specific case are about $3,000, every time a subrogate insurer needs to file an answer and they don't have to attend a hearing and the court has to hear a hearing on motions to realign the caption and motions reopening and motions for default judgment, that's wasting the court's time, that's wasting my client's time, and ultimately, if this issue is clarified and it's held by the Supreme Court today that they should be named as plaintiffs, we'll avoid all that.
You get these cases all the time, right, counsel?
I clerked for a plaintiff's firm for 2 years, and I was on the other side of many, many, many of these hearings. This is everyday practice. This isn't something that is only going to come up now and then. Touching on the Chief Justice's point, there's been no prejudice to the plaintiff in this case. There's no prejudice in this to the plaintiffs in this case that we didn't originally respond. We got our answer in, albeit late. We filed our motion to reopen. There was no prejudice to them that we didn't file an answer on time. I think most importantly is that what we're asking for today is to clarify what the law is to prevent this from happening in the future. The statute pretty clearly states that they should be named as a plaintiff. The Court of Appeals have interpreted that way. In fact, Anderson versus Garber says so, and Sampson versus Loke says so, and I think Sampson's an important case to look at. Because in Sampson, you had a subrogated insurer that was named as a defendant. Nobody raised a beef about them being named as a defendant until the plaintiff lost. Then the other defendant says, wait a minute, they're supposed to be named as a plaintiff. We can collect costs against them, and they did. So are we going to treat these subrogated parties as plaintiffs, or are we going to treat them as defendants? The Court of Appeals says we should treat them as plaintiffs. Today we're being treated as a defendant. I think they should be named as a plaintiff, and I believe the law supports that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hetzel. That concludes 97-1490 FT. The court is adjourned until the November 6th.